No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE, BBS Radio 1. Again, the number is 888-627-6008, and we'd like to make you part of the conversation tonight, because it's just me and Maria. There's so much going on in America right now that we decided to forgo having a guest tonight and just talk about what's on our mind. Are you with me there, Maria?
Yes, sir, I am. How are you?
I'm good. And congratulations on finishing all your exams.
I know
you've probably done really, really well. And
yes, last week was finals, and so I had a final Tuesday night, a final Wednesday night, a presentation Wednesday night, a presentation Thursday night, and a final paper. So let's just say Friday, I felt like I was just walking through the motions. I literally didn't leave my house. I slept in, and I even stayed out of technology. I was just reeling. So that's behind us.
I remember those days. I remember when my girlfriend cooked me dinner one night and I actually fell asleep in the middle of eating it, which annoyed the hell out of her because I hadn't had a decent night's sleep in 2 weeks. So
imagine doing this at this age. Yeah, no.
I'm so old I can't even remember what it was like to do it. So
it's not easy, let me say that, but it is fascinating and stimulating and applicable, and I've learned so much as a human being, and with my internship at the Cancer Support Center, that is just a mind-opening. It's all good, shall we say.
Well, and you know, I think that's important in life, is to keep going and keeping things fresh and new and continue to learn. I think that's very, very important for people, so I commend you in doing that.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in the world. Poor Donald Trump. I'm starting to feel sorry for Donald Trump.
Are you?
Yeah. What a bad week he had.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I do. It's almost like cringing. And is it a train wreck yet? Or is it, you know, what is it? Is it a crash, you know, like in the Tour de France? Or, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, I think the thing that helped him become popular is now the thing that's working against him. You know, that he really doesn't have any experience at doing this. And in the beginning, this is my own pet opinion, but in the beginning, I think that's what attracted people to him. That there's obviously sentiment out there that people don't want the same old, and he definitely wasn't the same, you know, he definitely was outside the box. And so was, strangely enough, Bernie Sanders. You know, it's hard to think of Bernie outside the box because he really has been establishment for so long, and he's a United States Senator. But they both had that kind of persona going on. But in Trump's case, he really was outside the box. And I think this is coming back to haunt him. His people just are not doing a good job.
Well, and apparently he's got like 60 folks compared to Clinton's 600. So he's it's too lean. And then he hadn't bought any airtime, and now he's trying to. And of course, the ripest choices places have already been plucked by other candidates who are doing TV work, you know, ads and stuff like that. It's almost like it's too much, too little, too late. Even though there's 100, you know, 90 whatever days now left.
Yeah, well, you know, people don't focus, right? They don't focus until the last 90 some days. So we're in that, we're at the start of that period, really. But, you know, I really saw the difference between going to the two conventions. And we've seen that as Hillary Clinton got an 8-point bump out of her convention, is that just the way they were handled. And not because the Trump campaign did anything colossally wrong during the campaign, other than cut the Republicans out. They cut the traditional Republicans out. And there is a learning curve here. And these guys who have done it over and over and over again just weren't there in Cleveland. And it showed. It showed in the type of convention they put on.
Well, and I don't know why not. I mean, what's the point if it's do or die now? And they're saying even his children aren't as involved post-convention because they're attending to their lives and their needs and what have you. But they're the ones that seem to be able to wrangle him in more than anybody. And that's not helping him either.
No, and you know what? I think the big thing is that the Republicans, and this is much to their discredit, I think, in the long run, it's really going to hurt them. They're already saying this guy is tearing our party apart, and we don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to run next time with my opponent putting pictures of me and Donald Trump up. I don't want to be, you know, I think they're saying that. And you've got, you know, you've got all these Republicans, conservative Republicans coming out against them. And I think that's, you know, the most damning thing of this week, when you have people like Charles Krautheimer and Bill O'Reilly and Michael Hayden, who was Bush's former CIA director, coming out and saying bad things about the Republican candidate. That's hurting them the most, more than anything else.
Yeah, and then he, until Friday night, announcing that he was going to endorse Paul Ryan, but Pence broke with him during the week and was like, I'm going to endorse him. You know, I mean, your own vice presidential candidate not following, which I happen to appreciate that Pence has his, you know, own mind and he has his loyalties, which is the right thing to do. So, it's a mess. Michael, it just must make all of you on the Dem side so happy. It's like,
well, I mean, it would if it weren't for the fact that it would make me so happy. It really helps our cause in terms of, because we have such a partisan cause, if the Democrats do well in the House and the Senate. But I've got to tell you, as an American, I'm disturbed by the fact that we have two candidates. I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter, but we have two candidates who have very low positive ratings. And
yes.
And I don't know what that says about us as a nation.
Well, and historically, we might add, this is uncharted territory in a lot of regards, and not many of them good. There was an article in my local paper today that one of our county supervisors who was on the central committee has resigned because of Trump. You know, we're talking stalwarts and, you know, hard line, long time party loyalists. And, and my county is very conservative. Like, my county people win who are Republican. it's not the state, but in the county.
Well, you know, we're just the opposite, of course. Democrats in Washington, we make jokes about how few Republicans there are, because you win the Democratic primary in the District of Columbia, you don't even bother to show up for the general election. What I always do is I go out with my wife and give out donuts to poll workers on election day, because nobody that's ever won the Democratic primary has lost the general election. And that includes people who have been indicted between the primary and the general. They still win the general election. So it's just
really interesting.
Here.
Yeah. Situation.
But, you know, those of us that make a living at politics, those of us who have been involved, understand that we need the Republican Party. The world, the country would not be a better place if there were only Democrats than if there were only Republicans. The two, that's how America works, right? It's a balance of power from the way our government's set up to the way our politics work. And right. we have to have those two opposing sides. And I don't know what happens if the Republican Party degrades too much. Does it lead to a multi-party system? And I think that I don't know how that'll pan out in America. I know it hasn't worked well for the Italians. You know, in some way, Italy is the greatest democracy on the planet because they let everybody run the government for like a week or two, and then they hand it on to the next. You know, they've had 50 governments since the Second World War, I think. But is that a healthy thing? I don't know, and I don't know that we want to see in America a Labor Party, a Conservative Party, a Liberal Party. And we're seeing one thing that I think is really interesting is we're seeing the Libertarian candidate with 8% of the
yes.
vote now.
And
that's more than we've ever seen.
I had one of my sons and his fiance over yesterday for brunch, and we talk about everything, and they were both Bernie supporters, huge time, and then they are now talking about the Independent Party people, yeah. not the Independent Party, but, and we're talking, they're millennials, okay, and so I'm thinking, right. it's, and then I have a buddy who's one of my best friends from college, he sent me a text over the weekend and said, not Trump, but, and, you know, it's not the anything but Trump. But so I'm seeing it within socioeconomic as well as multi-generational. And Gary Johnson is who my buddy from college is for.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think we'll see more of that. And I think it makes sense for millennials who are saying, look, let's roll the dice here. I mean, I'm not getting what I need out of America and not from the Democrats or the Republicans. So let's roll the dice. And the thing that bothers me about the whole campaign is a campaign where both sides are saying, you don't want the other guy. Mm-hmm. You don't want Donald Trump. You don't want Hillary Clinton. How about what we do want? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that's bothering me as a politician. Let's get out there and start talking about what America wants. Instead of saying, hey, look, I may not be great, but I'm greater than the other guy. What kind of campaign slogan is that? I don't get it.
Well, the other thing that's disheartening for us here in California is that the same son, they're getting married in June of next year, they say we're not long for California because we can't afford it here.
Right.
We want to have a family. We want to have a house. They don't have student debt, fortunately. So they're like, don't count on us being around. And I don't know about you, but my folks were around when I was getting married and having kids and stuff. Not that they were your little league and AYSO parents, grandparents, but they were still there for the sacraments and for birthdays and stuff like that. To not have my families not be around me, it's devastating for me to even consider it. I mean,
well,
I understand, if it's a career thing and somebody got a job in Boston or something, well, of course, you know, you got to go where the money is, but not because they're talking Nevada, Florida, or Colorado because they can afford it, or Texas.
Right. Well, and we're certainly seeing that. My wife and I couldn't afford the house that we live in if we had to buy it today. And we don't know how our kids, you know, to rent a two-bedroom apartment in the District of Columbia is $3,500 a month. We can't see how our kids can possibly live here either. Now, as far as getting married and having children, my oldest daughter has a boyfriend now, which I'm totally against. I've said to her, don't do whatever you want, but wait until daddy dies. Don't
no.
date, but
tell
but
me what
she's 23 years old. She's 23 years old. She's running out talking to boys. I don't understand that.
Yes, I understand.
But she lives in Chicago, and that's the point, all kidding aside, is that she's not coming home to Washington because she's more comfortable in Chicago. Not that it's cheap to live in Chicago, but it's cheaper than it is in D.C.
Wow. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah.
Michael, I understand that you had a birthday.
I did. I'm one of the oldest Americans.
How did you let that go by without us acknowledging that?
Well, you know, I'm trying to keep it on the down low.
Doesn't mean that it doesn't happen.
I know, but I'm afraid they might come and take me away somewhere. Yeah. You know, to say you're just too old. You're too old to be on your own. You know, Bill Cosby said, not that he's a great guy to quote, but he did write a book on fatherhood, and he said that's what, you know, when you get to be my age, your kids just wait for you to misplace your keys so that they can send you off to the old age home and confiscate your property. So I guess I'm a little afraid of that. I don't want to make too big a deal out of it. I got to tell you, as much of a cliche as this is, it seems like only yesterday when I was 21 and Saturday I turned 63. So,
that would be yesterday.
Actually on Friday.
Okay.
I turned, 63.
So what did you do?
We had dinner. We had some old friends over for dinner and one of them gave me as a birthday present, night out and Paul McCartney concert tickets on Tuesday. So
really,
So we're gonna go see my friend Bonnie and Pat, and I are gonna go see Paul McCartney. Go to dinner, have a good dinner, and go to see Paul McCartney on Tuesday. So that'll be fun.
That sounds fabulous.
Yeah, and had some old friends over, and my kids actually had dinner with me and hung around a little bit. Yeah, I'm sure because of threats made by their mother, if they try, she probably confiscated all the car keys.
Whatever it takes, Daddy.
Yes.
And you know that's not true.
And you know what? I'll take it either way at this point. But that's what we did, and thanks for mentioning it. It was fun. And
good.
I remember many more. Thank you. I remember, you know, the younger days when you had to go out and you had to do something big. Mm-hmm. And you had, now I'm like, you know what? I got what I wanted for dinner. I'm getting to go to see a concert. That's like great. It was that way at the convention. You know, I was at the convention with my old sidekick, who you know, Kathleen Gomez, who's been to 6 or 7 conventions with me now. And when we met at our first convention in 1980, we went to all the parties. You know, we went to 15 parties a night. Now we go to one party. It's 10:30. It's like, oh, you know, one night we looked for a party we couldn't find, and we ended up at a diner, and we stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was like, oh, it was like a big deal. You know, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh.
In the old days, we would have still been looking for parties at 4 o'clock in the morning. But it certainly has taken its toll. The years have taken its toll. But we had a good time. You know, it was relaxing. Yeah. After a while, all the parties get to be the same anyway.
That's why there's the younger generation. It's, you know, you pass the baton. It's to my daughter, because she's my frequent traveling companion. And this year for my birthday, I took us on an international cruise to South America and then back up to Miami. And I was out of town on New Year's Eve and on my birthday. And I've decided that's the way to go, because there's no fanfare. And it was what I want to do. I went zip lining in Costa Rica on the day of my birthday. And I couldn't have been happier. And she says to me, but Mom, you're not the same mom. And I was like, what? She said, you always close the clubs with me at 2 o'clock. Now you're leaving at 12:30. And I said, at least I'm out.
Well, there you go. I could be
having hot chocolate in our room.
Yeah. I'm at the point now where that's what I would be doing. I would be having hot chocolate watching you zip line. you know, from a safe distance where I couldn't break anything.
Well, I have to say that she was afraid. She wanted to go first, and she has a fear of heights, and she's got a couple of other little paranoia things. And I said to her, "I'll go first if you want." She goes, "Nope." And she takes the leap and screams the entire way down the first leg of it. I was like, yeah. "Yep, that's my girl."
You know what? It's my only real phobia in life. I really
is heights.
Fear of heights, yeah. Mm. And we actually, when we were in Hawaii, we took the the kind of compulsory helicopter thing over the volcanoes, and I was so worried about it because of my fear of heights. But it didn't bother me at all. It was really
good.
Cool. Yeah, because the helicopter's so gentle, and you know, it's an amazing contraption. I'm surprised that it even works, but it does, and
yeah, it defies
and it didn't bother
logic.
Me. And usually, I'm worried about things like that. But you know what? I found the most interesting story of the week politically.
Okay,
and I want to know what you think about this. That there's a group of Trump people who are targeting the Amish. Did you read about this?
No, that has escaped me.
They're targeting Amish voters. There are 70,000 Amish voters in Ohio and Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
Now, Ohio and Pennsylvania are, of course, battleground states. So every vote counts. But nobody's ever targeted the Amish. I don't think the Amish are even supposed to be politically, you know,
I was wondering about
active.
That. Yeah.
Well, they're registered to vote. And this group is putting up billboards, and they're, you know, kind of traditional media because, excuse me, because Amish people don't watch TV and they don't listen to radio. So they're trying to get them in print through print media and billboards. And, you know, there's an old, I can't remember what despotic philosopher said this, but he said you grow strong on what the enemy leaves behind, and I think that's an important thing in politics. We saw Obama, for example, take the lead against Clinton when she had pretty much all the cards in the deck. Because she ignored the caucuses last time, and Obama focused on the caucuses, and that was what gave him momentum at a critical time in the primary process, and that pushed his campaign ahead. He might not have gotten very far if he hadn't done that. So I find it interesting that these Trump people have seen the Amish. That nobody's going after, I'm sure. You know, they're just.
I heard there was a Amish pack, and it is pro-Trump. So I'm wondering if that's what's behind what you're talking about.
Right, that's exactly who it is. It's the pack. That's.
So it's their people. Pack. It's not like somebody coming from the outside to infiltrate, if you will.
No, it's their people, and really, I wish I knew more about it. I'm gonna have to look into it, because. If you asked me, is there an Amish pack? I would have said, no, I don't believe that the Amish give money to politics, but obviously there is. So,
because I did see it was a horse and buggy, and on the back of it was a Trump banner, if you will, that said, make America great again. And if that doesn't paint 1,000 words, right? A horse and buggy with Trump on the back.
When that's your strategy, that's a little tough. But we'll be going up to Pennsylvania next month to celebrate my father-in-law's 85th birthday. So I'll keep an eye out because my sister-in-law lives in – we go right to the center of Amish country to get where we're going. So keep an eye out for the buggies with the Trump stickers on them.
Yeah,
I just thought that was interesting. And also another big story this week, the stock market is just going crazy, huh? It's at 18. The Dow Jones is at 18.5. I think it's the highest it's ever been.
The reason I don't pay attention to that is because I'm not one of those knee-jerk people that move things around depending on what's going on and the sky is falling and all that. I'm like long term. And I have somebody that I have trusted for almost 20 years now that makes those decisions on my behalf. And he's also the same kind of way. So I don't get it why people take advantage of those swings in the emotions that, well, I guess like the Brexit thing. Look at, you know, that affected us too, the stock market. And then we smoothed out.
Right. Well, that's, I remember in, I studied economics as an undergraduate, and I remember one professor saying to us, if you want to play the stock market, don't subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. He said that's the worst thing you can do, because what happens is you see the stock going up and you buy it, and you then you see it going down and you sell it.
Sell it.
He
right.
says, so you're always buying high and selling low. Mm-hmm. Which is the opposite of what you should be doing. Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, you know, deal either learn what makes the stock market work or find somebody that knows how it works. And I was lucky enough to find a great guy just like you who always plays the long term, never the short term, and two, hates to give you any of your money back. Which I really like. And, you know, like you have to argue with him if you want to take money out of your account.
Yes.
So, you know, he's just, and the first time I met him, this is a true story. The first time I met him, he was about, he's been helping us for 25 years, but he was about 35 years old and his hair was white. And I said to my wife, look at this guy. He's gotten gray hair worrying about other people's money. It's not even his money. I said, this is the guy I want, you know, and he has, his name is Dan Hill. He's a great guy and he's done great investing for us and helped me put all three of my kids through college. And that's exactly the way he's done it. We don't go into anything, for the short term. Yeah,
and then we've got the Olympics. Do you follow that?
Yeah, I just watched the women beach volleyball team get slammed, and I thought
the United States.
Yeah, but
because they won their first match, like
yeah, it's not the woman who's been in there for years. Whose name I can't remember. This is like her fifth Olympics. She's part of the beach volleyball team, women's beach volleyball team.
Uh-huh.
It was another team. And my wife said, well, there's more than one women's beach volleyball team from the United States. And I'm like, why? I mean, we have one swim team. We have one track team. Why would we have multiple volley? So I really don't understand that. But, yeah, they lost to, Hungary, these other two women, but it wasn't the woman who's won several gold medals already at it. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. And I heard that we won a gold medal in shooting.
Yeah, the gal did. She won the first gold for us. And it's air something. I just read about it today. She's 19 and I didn't even know it was a sport, but she's apparently got nerves of steel that she just kept doing what needed to be done in order to win. It's like, go girl. Can you imagine at 19? It's like, well, no pressure there.
I'll tell you, I had a teacher when I was in middle school, Mrs. Reams, I'll never forget her, a little tiny lady, and she won a medal in the Olympics as a shooter. She was, I can't remember if it was biathlon or what she had won, but she had won. She was one of the top marksmen in the world, and they had a picture of her in the back of Life magazine. You know how they used to do those pictures every month? And they had her, she split a bullet in half at 100 yards or some ridiculous thing like that. And she had the poster blown up and the picture blown up to poster size and was on one wall of her classroom. And she was a little tiny woman. And if you ever gave her a hard time, she would slowly open the middle drawer of her desk and reach inside, you know, and all the kids would shut up right away, right? She would remind you that
Don't
she was one of the world's top marksmen. But yeah, I've always been amazed by those people. And biathlon, you know, that's a thing where you're on skis and then you drop and you shoot, and you get up on skis again. And yeah. I mean, that's just an amazing
thing. And how you would get into that. Usually there's a member of the family that's done it and exposes you to it, right?
Oh yeah, I would imagine. You know, my father was a marksman and he taught us all how to shoot.
Me too. My dad too.
Yeah.
He went to a military academy for high school that he used to take his rifle with him on the bus to school and back every day.
Yeah. No, I know people here used to do that.
Really? I mean, talk about that wouldn't pass. And this is in Chicago, no less. So, but yeah, it was no big deal. He had on a uniform and he went to this military academy and you needed to have your rifle with you.
Well, you know, when I was 16 years old, I went to Spain with my sister and we went to Toledo. And of course I bought myself a sword that was 4.5 feet long and I brought it home and put it in the overhead compartment to bring home on the plane. Imagine. Now my daughter had her class detained in Germany on a class trip because a kid bought a slingshot in Italy. And slingshots are illegal in Germany. They may be.
Are they?
Yeah. At least this kind of slingshot. I don't know. I'm sure it was some kind of high-tech thing. But yeah, they not only seized the slingshot, they seized the kid. And their teacher had to beg for leniency to get him back on the plane. But when I think of that, you know, I brought the sword on, this big old sword. Razor sharp, you know, and everybody thought it was so cute because I was a 16-year-old boy and I had a sword, you know, and the stewardess wrapped it up and put it in the overhead bin for me. You know, didn't think anything of it. Today,
Michael, for you to travel to Europe at that age and in that time, that had to be rare air.
Well, I guess it was.
Absolutely. Know, international travel. I remember when we would go to Las Vegas, people would wear gowns. And suits and tuxedos. That was just Las Vegas. So to go to Europe?
Well, and I had long hair.
Oh, did you?
I had hair down to, you know, like I had a ponytail. And I remember my sister lecturing me about how I had to bring a sport coat and a tie because in Paris, when people went out to eat, we went to Paris and we went to Madrid, that people, when they went out, you know, men wore ties and jackets. I mean, and here we were like in jeans with patches on them and, you know, and stupid t-shirts that said, you know, things like King Kong died for your sins and, you know, and you know, Frank Zappa t-shirts. And I remember going to Paris and thinking to myself, these are the most handsome people I've ever seen.
Really?
Oh yeah, everybody was well dressed, and there. I just don't ever remember seeing a homeless person, or you know, they were just so, you know, so much more. Seemed so much more sophisticated than we did at that particular point in time. I don't know when we caught up, but yeah, it was unusual. And my sister and I had been through many, many years of hard times. So I lost both my parents when I was 15, and my sister, through much struggle, she was an amazing person, became a lawyer, and this was her first law school bonus, or law firm bonus. She got a bonus at Christmas time, and so she decided to surprise me by taking me to Europe at Christmas time. And years later, she didn't talk to me for 2 weeks because I told her the cute little story about how I rented out her apartment while we were gone so that I would have spending money. I sublet it to one of the kids I was in high school with, and I came back, and there were people that said things like, "Hey, man, I went to that party at your apartment, and how did you get 800 kids into a two-bedroom apartment? I never even saw you, you know?" And I remember thinking how cute that was, and I told my sister like 20 years after the fact, and she was so mad that she didn't talk to me for 2 weeks.
Did they? She not notice, or did they clean it up so nicely?
They cleaned it up, but one thing they did was somebody spilled something like a bottle of wine or something that stained the rug.
Oh, no.
So what they did was they took all the furniture out of the living room, moved the rug 360 degrees, and then put the couch strategically on top of the stain. So when we moved eventually and they moved the couch, my sister went, "Oh my God, look at this. Somebody spilled a glass of wine under the couch and we never noticed it." You know, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, that's terrible, man." Yeah, but they told me about that. They said, "Don't move the couch, whatever you do." And yeah, so whatever damage they did, they were able to
disguise it.
Yes. Yes, they were very resourceful.
I can't believe that you were able to be that ingenious and that creative and that productive.
I was a terrible child. I probably shouldn't be saying this on the air, you know, but at 15 years old, I was pretty much on my own because I had a sister who was trying to raise me, but she left the house at 6 o'clock in the morning. My sister worked full time for the chief of staff of the Air Force and went to law school full time. So she used to leave at 6 o'clock in the morning and not get home till 9 o'clock at night.
How did
so
she
I was
do
pretty
that?
Much on my own. Well, they made a special dispensation for her because because of our situation and because she had taken custody of me.
Okay.
And the law school did not allow part time. There was no such thing as a part time law school at GW where she went. But what they allowed her to do was they allowed her to go 12 months a year so that she could take a lighter course load in the fall and spring because she went over the summer as well. So they made some special accommodations for her. But yeah, she used to work directly for the chief of staff of the Air Force during the Vietnam War. She was pretty much an expert on Air Force involvement in the Vietnam War because what she did, what her job was, which I just thought was amazing, was she read six newspapers a day, like the New York Times, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the LA Times, and then she would write once a week a synopsis for the chief of staff of the Air Force about all the publicity, all the news that related to the Air Force's involvement in the war. So after doing that for 4 years in the middle of the Vietnam War, she just knew everything there was to know about how the Air Force was involved. And she should have written a book on it. If she had lived to be old enough, she probably would have. But unfortunately, she also died of breast cancer when she was pretty young.
Michael, that sounds like she had quite a tragic life.
She did, but you know what? She was tragic's not the right way to put it. She had a really hard life, but she was always a real positive person. You know, she took it all in stride and kept on moving. I mean, she became the first woman partner in a 75-year-old law firm in Washington, D.C. It was one of the biggest law firms in the city. And she just took everything is tried. I'll tell you just a great story real quickly is that when she started with this law firm, they had, among other things, Indian claims cases. And nobody wanted to take Indian claims cases. They were terrible. You had to take them against the government. You were paid almost nothing to do them. They were very hard to win. But my sister was new, and they gave her a bunch of Indian claims cases. And as it turned out, she won a major case for a tribe in Oklahoma who had their oil taken and sold by the Bureau of Land Management. But they sold it to a company that had no way to capture natural gas, which occurred with the oil. And they burned off tens of millions of dollars worth of natural gas and never compensated the Indians for it. So she sued and she won the largest single settlement of a case like that in the history of the United States. And all of a sudden, she was the Washington counsel for Exxon, Texaco, Mobil, got all the big oil companies. So she went from having this, you know, there's that old saying that when life gives you lemonade, lemons mm-hmm. make lemonade. Mm-hmm. She really did it. She went and overnight became a partner in the firm and one of the most successful lawyers in the firm because she had done such a good job for this tribe. And it really skyrocketed her to success. And I actually did work in the early 2000s with Native Americans, training them to run for public office. And it was through her connections. I went out to an Indian reservation to work for John Kerry and ran into lots of people who knew her and
so
got me involved.
How long ago did she pass away?
25 years ago.
Oh my gosh. She was young.
Yeah. 91. She died. So 25 years ago, she was 45 years old. And we thought that she would do it's the same thing that same disease my mother had. And we thought she would do better because she was younger. And it really, really.
It's more virulent the younger you are.
Yes, it really is. And you find that out, you know, when you find out about the disease, it's more virulent when you're younger. It's more so when you've never had children. She never had children.
And there's a family history.
Yeah, there's a family history. So I worry about my girls a lot. I have two daughters and we worry about them and, you know, try to make sure that they're as healthy as can be.
There's this new thing because of my internship with the cancer support community. I'm fortunately finding about what's cutting edge and what is working and what not. And immunotherapy, helping your own immune system, they say is now not only recognized by Western medicine, but it's being promoted. And we actually had an immunologist come and do a talk just last week. And the room was packed with cancer folks. And, you know, in various stages of their challenge and to help from the inside out that you have control over and choices to make is pretty empowering, too.
Well, I think we're starting to learn this more and more. It's funny that I have a friend, unfortunately, she passed away, too, but an old dear friend that was a nutritionist she was a registered dietitian and nutritionist who said, you know, doctors in America really don't know anything about nutrition. And I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. I'm sure that's not true. But after contracting diabetes, after getting diabetes and dealing with a disease that basically revolves around nutrition and changes you can make in your lifestyle, I realized she was right. There are a lot of we're just starting to learn about these factors that play such an important role, like nutrition and exercise and other things you need to do.
And mindfulness and stress reduction. And which Eastern world has known for centuries.
Yeah.
It's so funny that it's taken us this long to get with the program, to get jiggy with it, because we have cultures that have done it for generations. It's not some newfangled thing that, you know, we're out experimenting with nutrition and health and wellness. They figured it out. So I like it that we're getting more integrative with our approaches to medicine.
And I think of the things my grandmother used to do, you know, and just the things she had in her medicine cabinet, like witch hazel and, you know, things you don't even see anymore. Mercurochrome, right. and you know, all sorts of things, you know. Now, my grandmother had the most effective cure for everything. When you were a child, if you complained about anything with my grandmother, the first thing she did was give you an enema. So you never complained. After a while, you were like, no, that's okay. I'm fine. You don't look good. No, I'm good.
I was going to say she boxed your ears.
Yeah, I'm. Don't worry about it. I'm fine. you know, but all kidding aside,
speaking of Witch Hazel,
a lot of things.
I had a, I'm fair, so, and was raised in Southern California and did the baby oil thing and would come back fried, like red, blistered skin.
Yeah.
And I remember my mother cutting raw potatoes into slices and soaking them in witch hazel and placing them on my body to help leach out the toxins that the sun had put into my skin.
Yeah, I remember them using it for a lot of things that when you had a fever and stuff. I can still, you know, they say that your most distinct sense, memory sense, is the sense of smell. And I think that's true. I mean, there are things that, that I can remember from my childhood that I recall exactly how they smell.
And Vicks VapoRub.
Vicks VapoRub.
Up the nose, on the throat, in the little humidifier that would steam up the room.
And also a lot of attention. You know, I remember my grandmother feeding me in bed when I was sick, and I remember distinctly getting out of bed and running all over the house as a little kid, and jumping back into bed just in time to have lunch in bed. You know, that, so, you know, they used to dote on you too, which, and doctors that came to your house, we had doctors that made house calls. Our doctor always came to our house.
And so that was not my experience growing up in Los Angeles, but, I remember them talking about that. Was it at Marcus Welby was a TV show that, that's what he did, who he happened to live in my neighborhood. And it was like, oh, he doesn't make house calls. He only does that on television.
Doctors that came to your house and you know, I remember going to the, taking my grandmother one time to the doctor and having the doctor ask her how old she was. And she said, I'm over 65. And the doctor said, I'm your doctor. I need to know exactly how old you are. And my grandmother said, all you need to know is that I'm on Medicare and I'm over 65. Yes, she wouldn't tell his age. We didn't know when she passed away. Wasn't it till 10 years after she passed away that somebody found her birth certificate and we finally realized that she had been lying about her age the whole
really
4 or 5 years. Oh, yeah. My mother, we never knew how old my mother was either. They were very, very, that was a very big thing. But yeah, Dr. D'Elia, I still remember him. He used to come to our house. And today, last month, I had a test done at a hospital. And I've spent a routine test. And I've spent over a month and a dozen phone calls to the doctor trying to get the results from the test. And I can't even get them to call me back.
What's that about?
I don't know. But, you know, we're definitely going to have to do about a show about medicine in America because it certainly has changed.
Well, and on that note, I think I shared with you that my eldest has to have another mastectomy. He had one in 2008. This is different breast. And he's been denied the procedure twice now through his insurance carrier. So his employer who provides him the insurance got involved and they've now thrown him, my son, into another group of medical providers who is documenting the case and justifying the procedure, and it's going to have to be peer reviewed again. And this is medically, like, it went from uncomfortable to painful. They've ruled out cancer this time, so that's the good news. But we spoke this week and he said every day it's hanging over, looming over his head because he knows he has to have it. It's just when are they going to approve it because he can't take time off because he has to do it for the procedure and he's in pain. And he's got coverage.
Yeah, and that's terrible. You know, in my mother's case, I mean, we could go on and on about insurance companies, but my mother was covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield at one time and she left her job and went to another job. Where she was also covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield. And when she was diagnosed with breast cancer, because she had to wait 90 days to get insured in those days at her new job, the condition was pre-existing and they didn't pay for anything. Now, as it turned out, we were broke. We didn't own a house. We didn't even own a car in those days. Our car had been repossessed, and we didn't have a house. So when she died, there was really nothing to take. She took her debt with her, and it was about $50,000 or $60,000. And in 1969, $60,000, you could have bought a mansion.
Yes.
In the city we lived in for $60,000. It was a lot of money, but she took it with him. And she actually left. I was her only heir, I guess. She left me her insurance policy, which was $2,500. And the hospital moved to take it legally to put against her debt. And she worked at a college at the time, at a community college, and the community college told the hospital that they were part of the insurance plan, and they said they would cancel the insurance for every student in the college if they touched the money. So they backed, because the college was just infuriated, just like your son's employer. They were just infuriated by the fact that these guys were going to do this and take the, there I was an orphan. I was 15 years old, and they were going to take the only money I had in the world to apply it against the $60,000, where it wouldn't have even made a dent. So they stood up for me, and in the end, that helped me get through college. But yeah, just companies, they always complain about how much money they lose. And I'd like to know when we heard of the last one that went out of business. They all seem to do pretty well.
Well, and our premiums are going up, so becoming more unaffordable, which
yeah.
You had to know that was coming. I knew that. I remember when I got my Obamacare, which I'm not through Covered California, but I'm Anthem, then I'm paying for it myself, Blue Cross. And they sent me a bill for pediatric dental. And I said, I don't have children under the age of 18. And she said, but others do. And I was like, oh, okay. And so then I'm
paying for... You got to pay for them to have...
Yeah, and I'm paying for maternity care too. I said, this factory has closed. It's not making babies anymore. And she said, but others are. And I was like...
Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
See, I don't know about any of this. We need to have a show on this because I'm covered through my wife's employment. She's a teacher, and it's at insurance, and that's really all I know about it these days. When I ran my own business, my premiums went from, this is long before Obamacare, my premiums went from about $400 a month to $2,000 a month. It was the most expensive payment that I had. And in fact, my wife took her first job when she was, after raising her kids, she took a job at the school in the on the library part-time because they would give her health benefits. And even though they didn't pay her very much, she saved us $2,000
yes.
a year. $2,000
a month. Right.
Right. So we took that into consideration. That's what led her to be a librarian, but we should, we need to have a show about that. And we should let you know, America, if you're out there listening, that Maria is going away for 3 weeks. Is that right? Hopefully
that's
you do something fun.
Yes, and, in Europe.
And I'm going away next week to take my lovely daughter, Mary, who's gotten a partial academic scholarship, off to college.
How exciting.
At the University of Illinois. Yeah, we're going to take the whole week because her sister lives out there.
I was going to say, so you're going to have two girls in the state of Illinois?
Yeah.
They're both daughters?
Girls. Yep. They're both going to be there. And
wow.
Chicago.
Which campus is she at?
She's at the one in downtown Chicago. Her
oh.
sister lives right across the street. So the main campus of the University of Illinois is in Urbana.
Mm-hmm. That's what I remember.
Like suburb.
Champaign, Urbana.
Yeah, and she's in Chicago. So
how amazing. So not just in Illinois, in the same city.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're now in negotiations with her sister. I'm willing to send her sister some money if she'll rat her out. She'll play. Her sister's hanging tough though.
Is she going to live on campus?
Yes, she's going to live in the dorm.
In the dorms.
But her sister lives, strangely enough, right across the street from the campus. So she'll be in close proximity. So we're going to miss you next week, and we're going to we'll look for a good rerun to plug in there, and then we'll the following week, and we're going to miss you, Maria. I hope you're going to have fun.
I can't imagine not having fun. I'm going to be in Switzerland, so I'm looking forward to it. I've never been, and I'm going to be in Zurich for 3 days by myself, and then my girlfriend's joining me, and we're going to the south of the Alps. I have friends who have a chateau, and they've rented it to me and my girlfriend, and they've planned 9-day trips for us. I've rented us a car. Yeah, and it includes Lake Como and Milan and Austria and Liechtenstein, and we got our work in front of us.
Wow, that sounds like fun. You know, Kathleen's son is in Milan. He got a job right out of college.
I didn't know that.
Out of college, yeah, and he's got a job working for Fendi.
Oh my goodness!
In Milan. So,
wow.
So yeah, if you need a good handbag, let us know.
Okay.
Anyway, we're going to leave you, America. I want to leave you with a song. If we can play out this song, this is my favorite campaign song. It was Huey Long's song. It's called Every Man a King. So we'll see you in a couple of weeks, America. Thanks, and have fun, Maria.
Thank you, and have a great week, Michael.
All right.
Why weep or slumber, America? Land of brave and true. There's castles and clothing and food for all. All belongs to you. Every man a king, every man a king. For you can be a millionaire. Representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.